Naturally Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts. I'm Laurie Baker, and joining me today is bird researcher Professor Jane Reed of the University of Aberdeen. Her work looks at several aspects of bird populations, including their mating strategies, the factors influencing their life history, and variations in the size, structure, and distribution of bird populations in space and time. Jane, welcome to Naturally Speaking Shorts.
Thank you very much.
How did you first become interested in birds?
So I have a long history with birds, really. So as far as I can remember, I was really born with an interest in them. So I certainly remember from when I was really, really young, writing down what I was seeing in my parents' garden. So I think some of my first writing is how many robins was in the garden. And family legend has it that for my fifth birthday, I asked for membership of the Young Ornithologists Club, which at that time was the name of the youth part of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. So whether this story's true or not, the fact is that I was a member of that organisation from very young, and that was definitely driven by my interest rather than imposed by any outside force.
Excellent. And what made you to decide to pursue an academic career in ecology?
Actually, I tried my hardest not to pursue an academic career in ecology in some ways, in that I found biology in school extremely boring, partly because my school, in some ways that I went to, my bit more about mob control than education in some senses, so biology was awful. So I dropped it as soon as I possibly could in school, and I actually did A-levels in maths, physics and chemistry. And I started off my undergraduate degree intending to be a theoretical chemist, so studying maths and chemistry. But I'd retained my kind of passion for bird watching as a hobby all the time. And after the first year of my degree, I kind of realised that theoretical chemistry was not, it didn't involve much field work, and so I started to find it a bit boring. And I was quite lucky in that the degree programme I was doing actually allowed me to shift right across. So even though I'd done no biology at all since I was 14, I actually ended up graduating in zoology. And even then, I had no aspiration whatsoever to have an academic career in ecology. So at that point, I wanted to be more of a conservation scientist. My plan was to get a job with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. But I thought to do that, I would probably need a PhD. And so I thought, oh, I'm going to have to put up with three more years of study. So I started doing a PhD here in Glasgow with really completely the wrong attitude, because I thought, well, I'll just do this because I kind of have to, but not really expecting to enjoy it. And over the course of the 3 years, I got a bit addicted by research. And even at the end of it, I was still thinking, well, I'll just do one postdoc and then I'll go and get a job at the RSPB. So I did that as well, but I really enjoyed that, and so that was it really. I've ended up carrying on in academia without ever having any kind of a plan to do so.
And you spent a couple of years in Canada as well.
I did, so that was great. That grew out of my time here in Glasgow, so the Canadian project started in collaboration with Lucas Keller, who at that time was a lecturer in Glasgow, even though he's now back in Switzerland. And that was a great postdoc. So I was based at the University of British Columbia for 2 years, which is the point at which I started working on the Song Sparrow project, which I'm still very much involved in and which has really been one of the mainstays of my research ever since, really.
And some of your work has been looking at birds breeding on islands. Do you have an affinity for islands? And have there been any particular challenges associated with working with birds on islands?
So I wouldn't say I've ever chosen to work on an island particularly for the island's sake. It's more that the kinds of research I do requires long-term studies of marked individuals, and it tends to be easier to run those studies on islands because then you have a natural physical boundary to the population where you can stop looking for your marked individuals. So it just makes the studies practically a bit easier, really. That's why these things tend to be on islands rather than the mainland, where you could, the study area's basically so much bigger. Having said that, I do enjoy islands because they do have their own characteristics in terms of the ecology and often in terms of the people, which adds certain, you know, value in many dimensions. As you say, some challenges. So most of the islands I've worked on have been very lucky, really. They have very good infrastructure and that kind of thing. I guess Mandatee with the song sparrows is a bit more of a challenge because it is just a small rock and there's no people living there normally, there's no electricity, there's no running water or any other facilities. And so particularly when your fieldwork involves So I was doing some immune experiments on the island. That involved a bit of logistical chaos to do with how you keep things cold and how you keep things clean and how you recharge batteries and that kind of thing. But these things can usually be surmounted with a bit of forethought.
And I've been told that you're an expert at catching birds. Do you have any memorable field experiences of birds that were especially difficult to catch?
Oh, gosh. So I've been a ringer since I was 14. So again, that interest greatly preceded any aspiration to be a research ecologist. So I started training at that when I was still at school. So I've done a lot of ringing for kind of general purposes' sake, as well as for specific academic projects in the UK and various places abroad. So, I mean, sometimes the joy of kind of enthusiast ringing is you can basically catch what you want, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter because you can just kind of go home and try something else, which is a bit different from a scientific ringing where you tend to have a particular objective in mind, and if it doesn't work first time, you have to kind of go back and do it again. So some of the kind of enthusiast ringing projects I've been involved in have been totally crazy in terms of canonetting various kinds of waders in peculiar locations and that kind of thing. But again, particularly the song sparrow project in terms of a research project was quite... It kind of used all my experience, I think it's fair to say. So what I was trying to do there is run some immune tests on these birds where you have to catch an individual, inject it with an antigen, let it go again, catch it again more or less exactly 24 hours later, take another blood sample that you can then analyse for antibody titers. And those kinds of experiments we'd done a fair bit on birds in captivity, and also birds that were breeding at things like nest boxes, where it's relatively easy just to, when you see the bird go in, you block up the hole and then you've caught it. But I don't think anyone before or since, I think, has tried to do that same kind of thing where the individuals you're experimenting on really are free-flying around in the wild and there's no obvious way to get them back at the right time. So I had this incredibly military catching regime all set up to try and, you know, catch the same bird twice more than at least 24 hours apart. And, you know, some of them I didn't get twice, but a lot of them I did. And so I'm in some ways quite proud of that data set, more than just the scientific value of it, because I think it did take a fair amount of field skill to be able to collect those data at all.
So at the moment you're working on several different projects, and I was wondering if you could tell me about the species you are studying and what is interesting about them.
So the three main projects are on the song sparrows, red-billed choughs and European shags, and really all three of them were chosen largely because of the long-term studies that are going on, have been going on all three of them way before I got involved. Which allow me an opportunity to answer some questions that I don't think could be tackled any other way. So in terms of the song sparrows, what I'm really interested in there is the evolution of mating strategies. So extra-pair reproduction, so the situation where socially paired individuals are cooperating to defend breeding territories and rear broods of offspring, but actually the female mates with multiple males, and so some of the offspring are sired by a completely different male from the one that's helping her rear the chicks. And so I'm trying to understand how that mating system can evolve and be maintained. And alongside that, in the same song sparrow population, there's lots of inbreeding goes on, which is partly because it is an island population with not so much immigration. So again, I'm trying to understand how we might see the evolution of inbreeding or inbreeding avoidance in a wild population and what kind of effects might cause that. And that population is really great for that study because it's been studied since 1975, and every individual in the population has been marked since that time, so we know exactly who's related to who, so we can work out who's sired who and who's related to who, and so we can measure inbreeding and extra pair paternity very accurately. The other one that's been going for a while is on the red-billed choughs on Isla, so that project is much more about demography and conservation ecology. And that's a project that I'm working on with Pat Monaghan here in Glasgow and some other colleagues in Scotland. So that's really looking at what environmental effects cause variation in reproductive success and survival in different age classes of individuals, and how that can affect population dynamics, and then how we might go about managing those environmental effects, for example through agri-environment schemes, to try to ensure that population persists into the future. So that's that project. And then the third big one at the moment, which is an awful lot of fun actually at the moment, is on the European shag. So what I'm interested in there is in the evolution of partial migration. So partial migration is a situation where you have some individuals in a population that remain resident at the breeding colony all year round, but other individuals in the same population that migrate between summer and winter areas. And so what that means is you have individuals with two very different life history strategies that are coexisting in the same population. And of course that can have quite profound implications for population dynamics and for the evolution of other subsidiary traits. But no one really understands how partial migration can evolve or persist. And so what we're trying to do is to mark, well, what we have done over the last 7 years is we've marked about 12,500 shags at East Coast colonies in Scotland and the north of England with coloured rings that you can read in the field without having to catch individuals. And then we've basically gone and looked for them in the winter to find if, which ones have stayed resident at the breeding colonies and which one have migrated to go somewhere else. And at the moment we've got about 36,000 re-sightings of these ringed individuals in the winter. So we can start to build up quite an accurate picture of who's gone where. And so now we're just starting to look at who has gone where and why that might be. So whether it's different sexes that go to different areas or different age classes or individuals from different colonies. And we can start to look and see what implications the decision to remain resident or to migrate has for individual survival and reproduction and that kind of thing. So that's a project where we've been collecting data for 6 or 7 years, but the analyses are really only just starting. So I'm quite excited to see what's going to come of that over the next few years.
And so for your project that's looking at the song sparrows, how are you measuring the success of the individuals? So if they choose to mate with someone outside, or if they choose to sort of stay with their social pair, what kind of things can you see for how successful those offsprings are?
So that's a really good question. So the problem of trying to understand why we see extra pair reproduction, I think, is probably being one of the central questions, in at least in behavioural ecology, for about 20 years now, really since ecologists started to be able to genotype offspring and assign paternity as a matter of course. It's become evident that extra pair reproduction is virtually ubiquitous among birds and socially monogamous mammals and other things, actually. And so we've been trying to work out why it might be that that occurs. And part of the problem with that is it's been very hard to work out how you actually measure the costs and benefits of extra pair reproduction in a field situation. So what I've been trying to do with the song sparrows is to actually take a more explicit evolutionary approach. So actually using quantitative genetic approaches to try to quantify effectively the evolutionary costs and benefits of extra pair reproduction. And so that involves something a little bit more sophisticated than, say, measuring extra pair reproduction and seeing, you know, measuring a male or female's fitness in traditional ways. What I'm actually trying to do is directly estimate the genetic covariance between extra pair reproduction and components of male and female fitness. So we can actually then project evolution forward much more explicitly than we can by phenotypic analyses. So that's broadly what I'm trying to do, which requires a lot of quantitative genetic analyses using pedigree data and that kind of thing. But even so, exactly how you measure fitness is still one of the big challenges.
And then I was reading, it seemed like you had some surprising results for the song sparrows, that it sort of went against maybe some of the theories that you'd had initially.
Yeah, so again, one very strong hypothesis in terms of extra pair reproduction is that females might mate with extra pair males because the extra pair male is somehow of higher genetic quality than their socially paired mate. And so in some ways a female is trading up her mate by mating outside the pair bond. But what we found in the song sparrows is that at least with respect to some components of fitness, the female's actually mating with an extra pair male of lower genetic quality than her socially paired mate, which is completely opposite to prediction. And so that sparked a whole bunch of other theories or hypotheses about what the benefit might be that would then be sufficient to outweigh that apparent cost. So I still don't totally know the answer to that, but again, it seems to come down to the ways in which fitness components are correlated between males and females, in that it might be that there is a genetic correlation between basically female promiscuity and male paternity success. So there's some kind of genetic linkage between that female behaviour and male success, so that almost the females can't escape being promiscuous because the genes that cause that are being positively selected in males. And so it may be a case of sexual conflict, really, that's driving the whole system.
You were saying that it's fairly ubiquitous in bird species that they do have this extra pair mating. And so is there a reason that some birds seem to be more unfaithful than others, or do you think it's probably down to some of that sexual conflict?
That's a really good question, and I don't think we entirely know the answer. There's various possibilities. So there is some phylogenetic signature. So some groups of bird species, on average, tend to be more faithful than others. For example, some of the seabirds that really are lifelong socially monogamous tend to be pretty faithful. Interestingly, the red-billed chuffs that I work on and other corvids also actually have very, very low rates of extra pair reproduction, so we've just been trying to estimate that in the chuffs, and the rate of extra pair reproduction seems to be less than 5%, which puts them really down at the bottom of bird species. Other species are really ridiculously promiscuous, so the prime example is some of the Australian fairy wren species, where basically the female seems to never produce any offspring with her social mate, or, you know, at least kind of 70 or 80% of chicks can be sired by a different male. And I don't think we really have any unified explanation for why we see that variation. There's some links with life history, there's some links with phylogeny, but I don't think we really have a clear explanation.
So you were part of a paper titled Identification of 100 Fundamental Ecological Questions that was in the Journal of Ecology in 2013. Regarding birds, what would you say the biggest kind of fundamental questions we still have are?
So I think the issue of what are the big fundamental questions in ecology is a really interesting and challenging one, and actually part of the reason why I was interested and keen to be involved in that, the project that led to that paper, was to just see what other people thought about what those questions might be. And it was very interesting in the discussions to see the kinds of things that people were bringing up. So to my mind, some of the big questions that link to birds but aren't in any way restricted to birds are to do with how ecology and evolution link together, so how ecological change can drive evolutionary change and vice versa. And then the other thing I think is very interesting that perhaps, you know, again, is not restricted to birds but is very, very applicable to birds, is understanding an awful lot more about movement as one other dimension of life history variation that has perhaps been neglected in the past, perhaps because we have focused so much on measuring reproduction survival in island populations where we can keep track of individuals, which then by definition excludes any component of life history variation that involves movement outside that study area. And that's been very handy, as you know, as I said earlier, these island populations where you can track individuals throughout their lives, but actually they're pretty unusual in terms of most bird species, which do often move around the world an awful lot. And so I think what's really exciting in birds, as our tracking technologies will continue to develop, is we should be able to enable us to actually fully integrate various kinds of movement, so dispersal and seasonal migration, and maybe eruptive migration and other more kind of stochastic movements, into the whole framework of life history variation. So that'll open a whole bunch of new questions, I think, in spatial ecology and how that links to other aspects of ecology and evolution. So I see that area as one that's really ripe for development over the coming years.
And if you had the opportunity, would there be any policies you'd like to implement to protect not only seabirds but also just other birds in Scotland and the UK?
Part of the SHAG project that I'm working on at the moment hopefully will have some policy implications. So SHAGs, along with many other seabirds, are protected under EU law, so that means that the Scottish Government and the UK Government more widely has a legal obligation to look after those species. And one way they do that is to define special protection areas, which are typically defined around the breeding colonies, but of course completely neglects what these individuals and birds are actually doing at other times of the year, which of course is most of the year, because they're only at the breeding colony for maybe 3 months of the year, which has been completely ignored really in the past in terms of defining these protection areas. So what we're finding with the SHAGs is that we're finding that a substantial proportion of individuals do migrate outside of the breeding areas in the winter. They don't necessarily go very far, but they're no longer in the protection areas. And so the information we're providing, simply by providing our basic resightings of these birds in the winter, is already of great interest to Scottish Natural Heritage and the Joint Nature Conservation Council, in terms of how they're going to deal with defining protection areas for species that are seasonally mobile. And I think allied to that is going to be the issue of how we're going to deal with the dynamics of protection areas as the environment changes, if birds or populations start to move from where they are just now. So I think the policy that I would implement is to almost fuzzify the boundaries of current protection areas and induce a bit more flexibility, whereby they could be seasonally protected, or they could be, the boundaries could be adjusted as the environment changes and as we start to discover more about how individuals move between years and between seasons. I think that's going to be very important as things progress.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine a focus even just on where these species are deriving their energy sources and how those are changing will also be a big area. So I'd like to move on now to our quick fire round. So these will be some short questions about different aspects of your research or also just some fun facts. So I'd like to start with, what is your favourite bird fact?
Right, here's a great story. And this again is linked to the kind of new techno gadgets that allow us to track migration in ways that we could never have dreamed of even a few years ago. So there's a species called the great snipe, which, as you might guess from its name, is a large version of our common snipe. So it's a kind of wader that usually strolls around in undergrowth in marshes and doesn't generally fly very far. It just kind of feeds by sticking its beak in the mud. So it's not really a prime candidate for doing a spectacular migration. So these birds, I have seen a few in Scotland, but they're quite rare here. So they breed up in Scandinavia and they aren't there in winter. So we kind of knew that they migrated somewhere, but we didn't really know where they went or how they got there, because they were never seen at any staging post or anything. So some Swedish researchers put loggers on these birds to see where they were migrating to. And so they put some loggers on birds that were breeding in northern Sweden. And the following year, when the bird came back, they managed to retrieve some of these loggers so they could download the data and see where they'd been. And it turned out that these birds did a non-stop flight from Sweden to the Ethiopian plateau for the winter and sat there and then flew back again. How incredible is that? I thought it was just amazing. So that's definitely my favourite bird fact.
The next question. So if there is a bird version of Jeremy Kyle, what type of drama do you think would come up most often on the show?
A bird version of the Jeremy Kyle show. Now, that's a challenge. It would have to be something to do with kind of within family conflicts, I guess. And so there's plenty of examples of that in the bird world. So in some ways, a good one that I'm actually working on a little bit at the moment comes back to the issue of extra pair reproduction, because one kind of big interest in socially monogamous systems where there's extra pair reproduction is what the female socially paired male should do if he knows or suspects that he's been cuckolded. So he's effectively helping his paired female to raise offspring that aren't his. So there's quite a lot of theory to suggest that at that point he should stop looking after the chicks, because he's basically investing in chicks that aren't genetically related to him, which then of course would impose a cost on the female for having mated with another male in the first place. And so that's one kind of big argument as to why we don't understand why we see extra pair reproduction in the first place, because then it becomes costly for the female if her mate's then going to stop looking after the babies. But that really boils down to how related the female's mate is he's trying to rear. So I'm looking at the moment is what happens in situations where the female is actually mated to a relative. So that what that means is that even if she then mates with someone else as well, so that her offspring are sired by a male that she's not mated to, he is still actually related to the babies because he's related to her. And so then that can change the whole evolutionary dynamic of who the male should really care for. So I can imagine that the combination of promiscuity and inbreeding is quite a good one that that Jeremy Kyle would probably quite enjoy.
And if you could invent a new technology that would allow you to study your birds and get at some of your questions in more detail, what would that be?
One technology, I guess I've mentioned a bit already, that is kind of here already, but I think could still do with some development before it becomes really useful, is our ability to track individuals around in a non-invasive way, and a way that allows us to track individuals over many years rather than just over short time scales, and in a way that doesn't mean we necessarily have to get the bird back in order to get the data back. So what we could do is a like transmitting microchip that bleeps a GPS position every day for 5 years or something. That would be great. I think we're a way off that yet. Another thing that would be great would be if we could find some way of tracking when individuals mate, because at the moment we're very good at measuring paternity and observe babies, but we're not very good at measuring who actually mates with who, and those two things aren't at all the same. And we've got good data on one and absolutely no data whatsoever on the other.
And what is one thing you wish everyone knew about birds or the species that you're studying in particular?
I'm not so sure that there's a single fact that I wish everyone knew, because in some ways what I enjoy about bird watching and ornithology and ecology as a more academic discipline is that there's so many fascinating things out there that you can just go and see at any point. So in some ways, if there is a hidden secret about birds, I think it's that you can learn new things that nobody knows at all just by looking at what's going on outside your window or in your garden or around the coast in Scotland. There's so many new things to discover. And if everyone knew that, then you know we'd probably have an awful lot more interested people looking at things, and I think that would be good for everyone.
And to finish, I'd like to ask you what your advice is for young ecologists hoping to enter this field.
I think there are two attributes that come in extremely handy in order to be an academic ecologist. One of which is to be enthusiastic about what you do. So I do what I do because I find it fascinating and I really enjoy it. And so that kind of gives me the enthusiasm to follow things through. And linked up to that, I think particularly these days when there's not much funding around really, the other thing that comes in really handy is just to be pretty persistent. So I think you have to be strong enough to stick with your motivations and to try to follow things through, even if it doesn't work the first time or the second time. If you just keep trying, then I think there's a good chance it'll work in the end. So I think the combination of enthusiasm and persistence is pretty essential.
Well, Jane, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter @TheNSPodcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.